director of strategy and research in the main national health insurance fund in France, which is covering 85% of the French population. I begin just to say that the slides are available, which have been available only at full-time services, that they're there on the corner of the table to want the people from the setup. So I'm very glad to have been invited to be a visitor. Before I was in this position, I must say that I have done the exact opposite move. Than Peter, because I was heading a research center in health economics and public health, which I've been involved and still involved in a lot of research on health inequalities, and being part of different European groups and etc. So, to be honest, I was very glad to be invited, but I was a little bit surprised because I'm going to be very honest, I don't think that France is a very good example of what should be. So not that we are not in there, it's not like all our healthcare systems have their strengths and weaknesses, but I don't think this is our strong point in the way we tackle health inequalities in terms of the consciousness and the strategy. So, I will be very honest, I will tell you what we've been doing for the last 10 years, but I think that I'll take this opportunity to raise a few questions. Some of them have been partly covered this morning, but not all of them, so I think that France will be also a case study to try to see in the context of policy, which is still to emerge probably for at least in terms of global strategy. Do we have the answers? In terms of what should be our priorities. So I will raise a few questions with three points. I will begin as Marianne before me, divide the extent of the health inequalities as we see them. Then, what is the perception of the problem in France and how the what are on the policy agenda? And then, I'll deal with three type of action that could be taken, which might be of much influence in health inequalities, and I'll say whether they've been available or not, and what we have in terms of assessing of the impact. First, the extent of health inequalities, when we are everybody, we have huge inequalities, and they're basically increasing over time. So, for instance, you see here, I don't know if you see it very well, but it's exactly what we've been saying this morning. Everybody has benefited from increased life expectancy, but highly qualified white-collar workers have gained more than, for instance, manual workers, which means that the gap in 15 years, the gap was 6 years in the third period, and it's now 7 years, 15 years later. So, always this question of absolute inequalities, but the gap is increasing. It's true also in France. We know it, and we've had this figures for a long time now. We also know that apart from the question of mortality, morbidity, disability, it also means that the distribution is not even. And for instance, again, you have these two categories. I'm sorry because the slide is in French. I didn't have to translate it. But you see that the number of years with disability, different types of disabilities, is much higher in a shorter life. So it's worse for women in terms of at least years with disability. So we know all that, we have mentioned that, we're measuring it more and more, as you can say. The first one, which may be a little more puzzling for us, is that how do we compare to other countries? Can we put out here? And it's funny because when we had this first international comparison at the beginning of at the end of the 90s or the beginning of the 2000s, with rather old data coming from the mid 90s, this data has been showed already during the day. Basically, this is the Erasmus group first one, for your time, and this is the equity group. And this is the study that we have seen before, but it's not just showed in another way. But basically, on the left side, you have the ratio of standardized mortality between manual workers and non-manual workers with the poor active population, with a simple ratio. On the right side, you have the services curve with this concentration index that we have talked about this morning. And what was very surprising is this was the first figures to appear in the public debate, and we were very extreme, very bad position in terms of the ratio of mortality together with Finland, and very average in terms of services. So it was all the puzzling in the beginning while we said, those are the first data, maybe we have to accumulate more evidence to be sure, and maybe this sort of ambiguous result will disappear. But what is funny is that with the Eurofine project, a lot of data has been updated together from a large set of countries, we have exactly the same ambiguous result. And then compared to the same set of countries, in terms of mortality by for men and women, and it's not by official classified level education, but it's the same. Basically, we are compared to the same set of countries that before, we are exactly in the same position, and in a very bad position. And in terms of services health, we are really average compared to the same set of countries. So, the first thing which is puzzling for me, and not so much for the same person, is that we know perfectly that we can have biased measures with the services health, because people report their health in different ways according to their social position. But the important thing is, why is it worse in France than in other countries? I mean, what makes the difference in terms of international conversion when we go from one case to another? So this is the first question that I wanted to raise, but it has been part of the topic this morning, is that according to the type of indicator that we take, we think that the position is really extreme or it's more average, but anyway, we have been working with a lot of indicators, so we seem to have a big problem in France in terms of happening politics compared to other countries, even if the fact of having a larger share of countries with Eastern and Central Europe has also grown the extent of its importance, so we're more average now. Now, the second thing is that there is in France a growing awareness of the social inequalities, but there are more and more measures, there are more and more statistics published on that. There is more and more research, and a series of teams are devoted to this involvement in this field. But what can be said on the other side is that first, it has been said already by Duncan Martin, but it's not, and we don't issue real clear recommendations or prescriptions to policymakers in terms of what should be done now. Well, given the constraints in which we are, that we cannot change everything immediately, and we have generally also financial constraints, problems of sustainability of the system. So what would be the priorities in that respect in the real world? And the second problem, but it's again, this debate has been covered also, is that as in other countries, a lot of our researchers, especially social epidemiologists, think that healthcare is not the problem. Yes, because I don't think so. The question of my talk, which has been suggested, was really on these downstream strategies, that is, what is the role of healthcare? And this is what I'm focused on. So I'm not covering the whole strategy on health inequalities. But most of the research in France tends to conclude that the problem is that it's a problem of social inequalities in general, that healthcare plays a very minor part, and so we are really interested in knowing what healthcare could do to improve its contribution, even if we spend a lot of money on healthcare, which is an enormous cost also for people having to deal with the distribution of this enormous amount of money, and they say, well, maybe we could at least use this money in general in order to do something, even if it's a small part of the problem. But we don't have real prescription coming from the researchers in that matter. Because they need more again, because they think it's not a problem. We have had a few official reports in the last 10 years, mainly by the Public Health Committee, which was recorded in 1994. And this committee has been very consistent in issuing reports saying that we have to tackle that problem of health inequality. The first one that was published in 1994 had an objective on that, saying that we had to improve access to medical care and social care for the poor, and we'll come back to that. In 1998, that we had to extend public health insurance and better coverage, again, financial coverage for the poor, extend enhanced primary care, and have better networks of care, and so on. So, from this recommendation, some of them have been applied, actually. But what is quite clear in France, and I've said that to begin with, is that there has been no global strategy and no comprehensive policy aimed at reducing health inequalities. Even if there have been measures taken, which I think have a real impact of that. But nothing like, you know, the plan, the Dutch plan that you just explained, is published in France. One thing in terms of perception of the problem, I think that both the policymakers and also the public debate in France is really focused on, I think, a rather narrow perception of the problem of health inequality. That is, first, it's a problem which is really the problem of socially excluded people, a very single category of people who are very deprived and for which we have to do something. But other than that, there is no problem. That is, the question of the gradient is not really, it is rather ignored. I don't know if it's, well, it might be also a pragmatic view, because probably the priority would be to first take care of the poorest part of the population. But it's true that the idea that it's not only that there is a part of the population excluded and the rest is okay, but there's a gradient from very rich to very poor, this idea is not only in the population. And the second thing is that the view is that everything has to do with access to care. So access to care is a very hard subject to make in France, but it's really access to care more than health inequalities. And so the policies that are directly targeted at health inequalities are consistent with this view, which means that they have taken a category of people, the poorest part of the population, and they have improved the access to care, especially the financial access to care for this population. But there have been more broader policies on public healthcare organization, which I think may have a positive impact on health inequalities, but they've not been really assessed for this objective. So the three types, I will say a few words about three types of policies that have been conducted. The first one is really the one which is labeled as increasing equality, increasing access to care for all the population, that is directly linked to the problem of health inequalities, as it is viewed in France. And the two other ones are more general policies with, I think, positive impact probably, but it's not demonstrated on health inequalities. So, regarding the first policy, I'll tell you exactly what we've done, but what I'm interested in is the question that it raises. So we had almost universal coverage in France up to 2008. We have a social insurance system, and as all social insurance systems, we don't guarantee that everybody is covered there might be holes. So we have small holes that we have got, and we got rid of that in 2000 by saying that any legal reason. But in addition to that, in 2000, we implemented a supplementary coverage for part of the population that is a sort of means-tested supplementary insurance. In France, and from the very beginning, the care is not free, as the point when people use it. There has always been sort of principle of cost sharing, rather small cost sharing, and a lot of people are exempted from that when they are very ill. But when you are low risk and you go to your position, for instance, you have a GP visit, it costs 22 euros and you have to pay about 7 euros from your pocket. Okay? And it's like that unless you are seriously ill, so you have a risk of disease for which you are exempted. But you have a lot of more co-payments in the system. But at the same time, I mean, I don't know. I know that the theory is that probably care should be free. And it's the best way for people to have the access. But the question is that it's never free. In many countries, there is, in all our countries, when you look at macro figures, there is a good part of healthcare expenditures which are covered by public funds is never 100%. We are at 80% in the UK and in Latina are above us, but anyway, no one has 100%. So the question is probably the distribution of this private financial part which exists in our system. Well, we have spread it in a certain way on all care, and maybe in other countries it's probably organized differently. But what we've done is that we've have this implemented this supplementary insurance, which is free, given the fact that anyway 85% of the population was already covered by some sort of voluntary health insurance. So now we are more than 90% of the population has this sort of second compartment of our insurance. And then we have this threshold effect, because above the ceiling, people have no voluntary condition, they have to pay the payment. So we had a second stage, which was to allow a subsidy for people above the ceiling to buy some voluntary insurance, sort of voucher. So, this was a really great reform in France. I think in a time where we had financial constraints, we succeeded in raising the level of coverage of the population. And it had really good results. For instance, we have a lot of studies showing that the beneficiaries of this benefit have really equal care. For instance, for very specific pathologies and access to very specialized care, they are exactly the same utilization of the system as our people covered by type of insurance. But of course, it's not quite. I mean, it hasn't leveled totally the level of utilization. There is still a socioeconomic gradient, which is more global, for instance, in the use of specialist care, as there is in a lot of countries. France is one of the countries in which this inequalities of use of specialist care are important. The voucher system for these people above the first ceiling, it isn't working very well, which means that probably in that direct insurance is better than giving some subsidy to people to buy it. So there is still a fraction of the population with low income and no complementary insurance, which has to pay the payments directly. And the growing concern also in France is that the people who benefit from this free supplementary insurance have a very bad image among the professionals of care. It's very rather amazing because the physicians say, well, these people, they have everything free, they want everything, and so on. And there have been surveys and testing among professionals, and we have this growing concern about the fact that some professionals refuse this part of the population, which is also a question. But other than your two, we have some the second point, but just to take a small conclusion, the question that I raised about that is that since in all our systems we have a part of private funding, how should it be organized in order to be the best organization in terms of healthy quality should basic care be free and some care left entirely to the private market, or should there be some sort of separate treatment only for the rich or some countries and so on. So what is the right way of doing it, knowing that there is nothing like a real totally free system of care? Then more general reforms, we have, for instance, the organization of the healthcare system. Until recently, we had a very weak organization. It was, I think, it was like that we wanted to reorganize and non-being organized. So we had nothing like a referral specialist. Everybody could see a GP or a specialist or any specialist and a lot of specialists in the hospital or outside the hospital. And there were no constraints at all. So, and everybody was saying in French anyway, we never just to do the GP, it's impossible, we've not been used to that. So it has been done in 2004 on a voluntary basis, but with a financial incentive, and it worked very well. So finally, as a lot of other countries did, we are registered now with GPs, and we think that it is also something which is promising in terms of better care for everybody, but also maybe less inequality. Because we think that GP may be more responsible for the health of the population we serve, and that we might give them objectives in that respect. We are now in the process of giving them objectives in terms of quality of care, some sort of financial incentive, like a small component of P4P. And the question that I think it's probably, it might be positive for healthy qualities, but it's potential and it has to be demonstrated. But my question here is that, do we have a lot of research evidence precisely on that aspect, which is what are the organizations of care which are the most able or the most efficient to cope with, to try to reduce health inequalities on the ground? And we are all convinced that probably primary care, a strong primary care, is a good organization, but do we really have the evidence for that? And in what condition does it work? But I think it's also a question, because I think we're moving in the right direction, but it's not, I don't know if it's really a good space for us, the broad conviction that countries share that public care should be strengthened. And then we have a third type of policy, which was public health policy as a whole, but where we tried to tackle some risk factors which are heavily associated with health inequalities, for instance, smoking, and also, I think in terms of health inequalities, when you look at the diseases, the pattern of disease for which there are health inequalities is rather different from one country to another. For instance, the southern countries have cancer as being a rather big driver of health inequalities, while some other countries have more cardiovascular diseases. France cancer is a very the contribution of cancer to health inequalities is very important, and it's raising over time. This is what the graph said, I don't have time to comment. But then it makes sense to try to tackle the risk factors associated with cancer. And so, for instance, in the public health act of 2004, we have 20 concrete targets, not for health inequality work, there were two for health inequalities, but there were a lot of targets on the health status or risk factors as a whole. For instance, reduced prevalence of daily smoking in the adult population, or reduced the prevalence of alcohol, or reduced the prevalence of obesity and overweight. And so you see that there are results in that respect, because, for instance, for smoking, we are in 2006, it's targeted for men, but we are almost at target for women. And we had a lot of policies on smoking that we've talked about this morning, banning smoking in public places, in bars and restaurants, in schools and so on, on professional premises. So we had a rather heavy action on that, and it worked, obviously. So the problem is that, but it didn't work that well enough on the obesity, a little on overweight, but not that much on obesity. But what is funny, and it is out of my two last slides, is that I had in my the two same slides as Julian showed this morning, because it's kind of interesting that we were rather successful for smoking and not for residential. But when we look at the distribution of our risk factors in France, France is here, and we can see that family smoking is not that much, when it's, we are less unequal in the distribution of that risk factor than other countries, but we are much more in terms of obesity, especially for women. So maybe the problem is that in terms of priority, we probably should more try to tackle risk factors not only associated with a low metabolic disease in general, but associated with bad distribution of these risk factors.
Thank you very much. I know that after coffee we're going to have more of a discussion. But since we started late after lunch, I think you will allow 5 minutes more at the most. So we got to shorten the discussion after coffee. We didn't really give Danielle at the end there an opportunity to answer one or two questions. And I certainly, as chair, wanted to try to pull together some remarks that have been made about the afternoon's process of looking at case studies by country. And I want to comment a bit about general strategy. Is there, perhaps we should put it in the order of inviting a question or two for Danielle first before I wind up.
Is there?
Did you mean Marielle?
I was thinking about Danielle.
I'm Dominic.
Can I just ask about smoking interventions? Were there more than substantive interventions in terms of banning smoking in public places, or were there more individual-based interventions like smoking cessation, like you see in England?
Yeah, we reimburse treatments, treatments for smoking cessation, which is new on an individual basis. Basically, that's it. And also this collective policy on the banning and increasing prices.
I was fascinated by, you're saying that there isn't a difference or it isn't such a substantial inequality in smoking prevalence, but yet cancer is so dominant in your... I was wondering if there was a... is your recording of deaths under 75, or is it the total population in terms of the mortality? I was wondering whether perhaps you were picking up differential coding of death, cause of death in older population. And we do know an awful lot of doctors within the United Kingdom who diagnose ischemic heart disease for every death they present about.
No,
I don't
mean, is the recording?
I was just wondering whether you picked up the difference between France and having the contribution of inequality as being cancer, whether this might be due to differential recording practices in different countries, but mortality
in other people. When you look at what was issued in the beginning of the end of the 90s in the Erasmus, you see that there are similar countries, Latin countries, had cancer as a driver of health inequalities more than, for instance, Nordic countries or the UK, for which the contribution of cardiovascular diseases is higher. And I think back at that time, at this hypothetical, so maybe we had sort of transition in that respect, which, because for cardiovascular diseases, the gradient was reversed compared to the previous period. And maybe the idea was that maybe we would evolve from this more pronounced gradient in cardiovascular disease, but that now there was less inequality in that field in our country, in the Latin country, than in other countries. So it's not the case only in France. And what I've shown is only in France and the evolution of France, but we have also comparison with other countries.
In winding up this session, I felt that we did need to remind ourselves that I think we all accept in the discussion, as far as I've found it in the afternoon, people accept that there has to be a general strategy which has ingredients for each country, where you're thinking of having a strategy which is shared with other member countries of the European Union, certainly, and I would add, and with the developing world too, so that there is a sort of global and a regional component in the strategy, even before you begin inserting particular country-specific tactics and strategies as well. And I think everybody's been calling attention to the breadth of the multiple programs that need to be introduced. And I believe everybody is arguing too that the action outside the health services has to be more substantial than inside the health services, even though that is, of course, of extraordinary importance. And that adds to our difficulties in presenting a case for some improvement in cancer or HIV or whatever breaks that we're discussing. But I'd just like to say two things quickly in succession, which I believe help to organise a framework of a programme that we all need to share. And the first ingredient, really, is to say that the difference, the inequality between rich and poor countries has to be foremost in our minds, because it has the direct implication for how we act for the rich and poor within our own particular territories. And the strategy has to be very similar in the two. So that the example I would want to give you, and here I picked up two of our speakers, were saying, Peter McCara said, he was talking about the need currently for tailor-made solutions to the new crises that are arising, as if we've got to improvise, we've got to spontaneously develop new types of action to deal with something that has arisen which has not been predictable. Now, I would just want to extend that to say that that can also apply to countries in considerable civil war, or having a tsunami or an earthquake or a flood of some kind, which, as it were, is shared regionally, if not by the total population, and does impel the consideration of some striking temporary initiatives in policy. And that really has to be related to the question of how we have generally been dealing with impoverishment. And one of the things perhaps we need to just consider a bit longer, people have referred to lifetime solutions. And I've been party to a lot of examinations of changes in impoverishment during the life cycle. But there are times in life, and it probably applies to all of us present, when we have been a lot more prosperous than we have at other times. Now, if you consider that, then those countries which have adopted preventive general universal policies for, let us say, children, the elderly, disabled, the long-term sick, just to, and the unemployed, this is a kind of cyclical expected experience within all our societies, and therefore all societies have to plan for that as a sort of routine job. And the example I would give is for the European Union and OECD countries. If you look at them, we have a lot of discussion among us about France and Hungary and Poland and so on as to how they shape up in terms of their handling of health and how they handle social insurance and social security. But I can say categorically, since I've been looking at this closely in the last 3 or 4 years, the OECD countries now spend or commit 14% of their GDP, their national income, to social security systems. Now, among them, we find lots of differences, which we get passionate about. Some with more means-tested systems, or more proportionately devoted to means-testing than others. And we tend, the balance of argument, in my view, is that the Scandinavian countries come up best because they have more universalistic systems than the means-tested system in the UK, certainly. And you can look at this in Europe generally and find that if you were to look at what the distribution of inequality and poverty would be before you allow for social security, then poverty in all our countries would be 3 times larger, roughly. That is the OECD evidence. That the social security systems generally for the average in Europe diminish poverty from 45% to 15%. I say that's the order of magnitude. Of course there are variations. But if that is what a social security system of some consequence, even though we may argue about the ingredients of how that is constructed, when you compare that with the developing countries, you find that the poorest countries, India, it's 1.5% committed to social security systems. The World Bank has been arguing that most of Africa should spend less than 2 or 3%. The ILO and others are arguing about pilot schemes or voluntary charitable schemes and others where it's allowed to creep up a bit. But on the whole, we've been holding down the expansion of the social security systems which we have in the Western countries, within the rich countries. And that is a powerful reminder of the extent of inequalities that are growing. And those between the poorest countries and the richest countries have been growing the most. We have references this afternoon to the differences that in mortality that have grown in France, for example, and that you just gave a slide about. But the problem arises globally in the first instance, and therefore we have to recognise that only by moving towards some kind of establishment of the social security system generally in the poorest countries will we begin to reduce that. And by doing that, we begin to say, reflect ourselves on our own system and say, how far is that so exploitative and discriminatory for the very poorest, as I think you were arguing in one part, and not really reaching the others. Danielle was making the same point about trying to focus on the poorest group to give them some additional coverage, when in fact it didn't succeed on one hand with lots of people left out. It didn't succeed on the other because it was administratively extraordinary difficult to develop and operate. And then if you come back to the Human Rights Act principles within not only the Universal Declaration but the Convention on the Rights of the Child and the Economic and Social Convention too, that you have social security in place as a fundamental human right and an adequate standard of living. And you've got a framework of thought and analysis there which sits paradoxically alongside the evidence we're all collecting about growing inequalities. And the two are not really being put together substantially enough in terms of a framework which is needed. And this applies very strongly, of course, to health insurance, which has been spoken about. So, I'm sorry, I'm waxing a bit passionate about that. Look at the connected link which you, the two of you brought up very well, not only the tailor-made solutions to new crises, but the lifestyle in interventions for disadvantaged groups. which you spoke about. Now, that was a kind of a way of arguing that we do have cyclical experience through the life course, which we have to try and correct for. And we enjoy systems where we put in an income in social insurance for healthcare when we need it, or because we can't predict when, or putting in money so that we get a pension at the end of life, or we have some benefit if we become unemployed. Now that, as it engages the population, they're willing to do that kind of thing. And we have that routine cyclical problem, which the OECD countries have largely resolved, even though there are problems. But we have this new financial crisis situation, which affects that structure we put in place already. We have to try and accommodate it to that, but also improvise some new features in the financial crisis to deal with those who are exceptionally struck by the financial crisis and unemployment and so forth. And both those things really need to be put in place. Sorry to go on about it, but you've provoked me. And so may we break now for a coffee a bit late, I fear, and therefore apologies to the co-chairs of the coffee that's going to take place. If you could have coffee very quickly within 15 minutes, that would be lovely.
The co-chair has actually turned into one of the panel members, so that's why we've got four members. What we're going to do now is I'll give each speaker a couple of minutes just to summarize the key points from their session, and both will be giving us the view of the EU, probably something on this meeting, and putting the spotlight on both. And afterwards, all the questions, all the burning questions you've been holding on for the whole day, you can get them out. But the other thing would be, if we can get this session, we're trying to draw from the presentations and whatever the key messages were, and then we'll take this forward from this meeting. So I'm going to ask, in the order of the presentations of the sessions, Owen to go first, then, please.
As must admit, I struggle a little bit here in giving some comments, because I don't feel that I have a good impression of what the Commission really expects from this meeting, and perhaps from the broader project from which this meeting derives. So I feel that I can't really react to the objections, perhaps, which you have from the work. Now, given that, I think the first point I would like to make is to turn things around a bit and make an appeal from the scientific community towards the Commission for something that we would like. And, of course, that is data. So I think one of the points I was trying to make in the presentation I made this morning was that in recent years, methods in relation to the measurement of socioeconomic inequalities in health have, to a large extent, reacted to the challenges which data place on us in terms of the nature of the data, but also they have reacted to the opportunities which data provide, in particular the opportunities which have been provided when one has data which is very comparable across European countries, one can obviously make a much richer comparative analysis. And also, in addition to that, when one has not only a cross-country dimension to the data, but also a longitudinal dimension, data, then one is in a very privileged position. And really, I think when we have access to such data, I think you can rely to a very large extent on the academic community responding to to the data. So I would probably suggest that it is perhaps less important at this point in time to try and identify methods. It's more important to try and create an agenda for the accumulation of comparable data within Europe, which I think then the academic community will come up with methods which are suitable to analyse. Now there, I think it's I would like to hear more about the European health service system, which I have to admit that I've only recently tried to investigate a little bit and found it a little bit difficult to know exactly what is going on in relation to that system. I read about talk of a European Health Examination Survey, which sounds extremely exciting, but it was not completely apparent to me at what stage that is at, if it's likely to develop by be realised or not. So, if someone here from the Commission could tell us a bit more about the European Health Service service system, I think that would be very useful, perhaps for the academics here. Perhaps two other points. Second point, I think, is in relation to interpretation of evidence on health inequalities. And here, I think it's very important to realise what one is doing when one measures health inequalities. A measurement of health inequality or socioeconomic related health inequality is fundamentally a description. It's describing the correlation between variables. Now, having spent quite a lot of my professional life doing that, I also think that is an important thing for one to do. And I think it's important because by measuring inequalities, one draws attention to them, one sets an agenda, one raises questions which the scientific community can react to, but also the policy community can react to. And so I think that drives an agenda forward. But one has, I think, to be very, very careful about how one interprets the measurement of inequality, because it is fundamentally a description. So when one moves to the stage of policy formation, it's very difficult to formulate policies on the basis of measurement of inequality. And so, for example, one of the comments I made this morning to Martin McKee, that I know of no really rigorous evidence which demonstrates in high-income countries that income has a causal effect on health. That is despite there being a great deal of evidence that income is highly correlated with health. So that would perhaps suggest to me that the correct policy response would not be to do something about income. One has to do something about the things which are correlated with income. Now, saying that, I don't wish in any way for people to draw the inference from such a comment to be that this guy does not care about inequalities. I fundamentally do care about inequalities. But the point is to be very careful in how one interprets the inequalities. Now, even though there is, as far as I can see, very little evidence of a causal effect of income on health, that what I'm saying there is that once one controls for all of the factors which are correlated with income, then when income changes, health does not change. Now, probably part of the reason for that is things like, and Julian Gunn referred to this morning, things like whose time preferences are very strongly correlated both with income and their health. So, the way one would want to react, the way one would want to understand the things which drive people's choice of time preferences. Now that becomes a very, very difficult exercise then, because time preferences are things which are not easily observable. So the whole exercise becomes very, very difficult. But nonetheless, these are the challenges which one has to face. The third point I would like to draw attention to also is basically emphasising the last point I made in my presentation this morning, that I think it is very, very valuable to take a life cycle perspective to the analysis of healthcare inequality. And this has been also repeated in a number of comments made today from the Townsend, who referred to this just before the break of coffee, that the life course perspective is extremely important. And I think that is important because taking a life cycle perspective tells us more about the extent of inequalities. So it is, we learn much more. If we discover that not only are people in low socioeconomic positions, do they have a lower level of health, but that level of health deteriorates more rapidly over their life course, then that is a whole other dimension which one has to react to. So that is of fundamental interest. And then secondly, the point of this morning, that if one does take this life cycle perspective, then it gets us closer to understanding the mechanisms which may be driving the inequality. And my impression, my view would be that it is very, very difficult to understand the mechanisms which lie behind health inequalities if one does not look at changes over time. One has to look at changes over time.
Thank you. We go through the panelists and then we open for a debate. So on.
All right, thanks. Well, it's going to be a tough job to summarise with Martin McKee and Julia Legrand. in trying to find some common themes in what we were all saying, I think that one theme that struck me was that the title for our session and for the last session as well was Policy Interventions for Reducing Health Inequalities. I think one thing that several of us said was that policy interventions, it depends on what inequalities and it depends on what areas of social determinants we're talking about. So we cannot lump together all types of inequalities and all types of determinants. But another common theme, I think, is that several of us were saying that, well, some things seem to be working. It might range from individual change of individual behaviors through either incentives or regulations or what have you. There might be strengthening of communities and local societies by labor market policies, perhaps active labor market policies or work, welfare to work programs, environmental improvements of various kinds, improvements in educational systems or other types of essential resources in the local community might be changed, and that might, and there may even be very hard evidence that that work. And even maybe, at least I was trying to argue that even national social policies can be designed in different ways, and some ways are better or more able to produce health among the citizens than other ways. And as we heard recently by Townsend, that universal systems might be more able to do so. And saying that actually back to the individual level, again, because these social policy systems, what they are doing is really to sort of strengthen the individual resources, strengthen the individual life chances, if you like, and improve chances to live a healthy life and make the right choices. So one central theme, I think, from the part that I was part of, may be that the individual, him or herself, and the family he or she lives in, what is very important, I think, is that the conditions they live under and the actions they are able to take are very important for the health they are able to to have, and that there are various ways you can support the resources that they are able to produce for themselves. Having said that, I think there was one thought that has struck me several times is that we often in public health refers to the concept of upstream and downstream, determinants and also upstream and downstream policy interventions. And sometimes I think that this is not very helpful actually, because in the end it's individuals that fall ill or die prematurely. And even sort of very structural interventions like national social policy schemes are actually in the end providing people with more money than they else would have had, or providing them with services for no fees that they otherwise would not have had. So in the end they are actually intervening in individual people's lives, in that sense being very much downstream. And also, and this was actually this discussion I once had with Johan Meichenbach, that it's very often we make the false assumption that individual behaviors only can be treated as on an individual basis. In fact, I think that, as Simon Legrand was arguing, that you can have changes in individual behaviors by changing the taxes or doing other very structural changes in society, and individual behavior will respond. You don't need to have intervention programs directed to poor communities to have people to stop smoking. You can raise taxes. Probably a wise decision is to combine different approaches, but we shouldn't sort of restrict ourselves to have only individual interventions to deal with behaviors. The personal reflection is some of the things I think that would actually work on in our project.
Thank you. Again, it's very much as a personal reflection on that. The afternoon session. There seems to be an unresolved tension between working across the gradient and targeting. In general, it's been proposed in the form working across the gradient is good and targeting is bad. However, there comes a point when working across the gradient may be oversimplifying. We are assuming basically that the same forces are working similarly in across a range of different experiences within the population. And I suspect that there are virtues from segmentation and from understanding different characteristics of particular populations. So I don't think it's an either or. But it is important to be aware that there is a tension. The second one I've picked out there is, perhaps from this afternoon and also from this morning, is that there is an imprecision about the concept of unmet need. I use the term, other people use the term, but in a sense it is an understanding that is conditioned by our expectations of the organisations that we're in. You know, we're saying, when we ask people, do you have an unmet need, it implies that they know the sorts of things that would be appropriate for them to have from a statutory or other public system. If they were expecting to get that resource from, say, their family, then they wouldn't necessarily say that they have an unmet need, whereas another response in another culture might regard that as being an unmet need. So we perhaps need to understand that, and that leads on to the question about inequalities, whether we're looking at inequalities at a between country level and between the within country level, and whether they actually mean the same thing. Looking more particularly at interventions, this is a personal comment, but there are places where it seems to work. I mean, I didn't mention this in my talk, because that was merely about resource allocation. The other papers reported on national strategies for reducing health inequalities and the issue of whether targets are a good idea. We have been working with targets within England for 6 years now, something about that. A particular target reduction in the health inequality differences in life expectancy and infant mortality. And we've been telling, I've been encouraging from the perspective of a regional representative of local government, of central government, local authorities and primary care trusts to work in partnership to achieve these targets. And for the most part it hasn't worked. In that, overall, the targeted areas have increased their inequalities from about the mid-90s up to about 2000. Narrowed significantly inequalities from about 2000 to about 2003, 2004, and since they've widened again, for no clear reason. But there are areas within England that have continued throughout that period to reduce their inequalities, both reducing their inequalities internally within the local area and reducing their inequalities in relation to the national average. Manchester is one. Kirby, outside Liverpool, that is, Knowsley local authority, is another. And I think there's probably something that we might learn from that, and picking up from one of the comments in this afternoon's session, perhaps we need to think about greater local autonomy, about not driving everything from a central plan, but looking at ways in which we can give people an ability to respond to particular local circumstances and encourage them to develop from the range of expertise, such as the expertise around this table, but to develop very particular strategies that may work for their area, but may not satisfy the standards of the clinical NICE or another organisation as being generally applicable throughout. So I think one of the things that I did pick up is the importance of perhaps thinking not as national strategies, but of looking at local specific strategies and how a constellation of local specific strategies might work, and what would be needed to give support to such a constellation of strategies, what, given that it's a dispersed analytical capability and a dispersed level of expertise. Finally, and I think picking up your comment, it doesn't seem to be entirely about money, but it does seem to be something about being poor. When we look at a biomedical model of self-rated health within the health survey for England, and we put in an area term, the way area term I put in was the one relating to the old GP health crisis, there is a very big area term which isn't explained by education, drinking, smoking, a whole range of things. And when we look at what that area term relates to, it relates to our deprivation. It doesn't relate to average income at all. And it doesn't relate to income inequalities within our local areas. So there's something about being poor, something associated with being poor, that doesn't seem to be being poor itself, but which is an underlying thing that is closely related to being poor, at least within the UK space, that is strongly related to health inequalities. I've been trying to at least tease out some possible dimensions for what that might be, but I think we do need a lot of other work from other researchers and perhaps some more thinking that isn't bounded perhaps by the debates that have been going on for a long time and that may perhaps constrain in terms of both ideological and perhaps professional silos and whatever. And for that reason, I think it's very useful that both the European Commission and Marmot group, for instance, seem to be looking at things on a more fundamental level than perhaps picking up on recycling the same old prescriptions.
Thank you. So, to finish on the time,
So, good afternoon. I'm not Anna Charrier, like it says in the programme, but I'm Ruth Patel, also from the Unity in Social Protection in DG Employment and Social Affairs of the European Commission, and Anna Charrier is here, and she will answer all your data questions, but she knows a lot. I got an old version. Okay, I will also have a few points. I think the first point I need to react to, what does the DEC want, the European Commission want with this centre? So, basically we are trying, the Commission has decided to put in its work programme for 2009 to have a policy initiatives on review addressing health inequalities between and within member states. And in this framework we are now working in trying to identify what are the main issues in it to look at and how they can be addressed. And hence, this is an expert. The idea of the seminar is to be an expert seminar to give input to this in this process. What we have ourselves sort of identified a series of issues of problems, which are more or less reflected by the seminar. Mainly the issues, I would just focus on two points, the issue of measurement and the issue of what policies. On the issue of measurement, I think that, this morning's session was very illuminating. I was pretty discouraged at the first coffee break. You can't use any of the data, completely forget any data coming from Eastern Europe, etc. But on the other hand, actually, I think that there is a wealth of information out there, perhaps not internationally comparable, but at a national level, there is quite a lot of information existing, which could be used better, of course. And yes, I think part of the Commission proposal would certainly be that we have to improve data availability, data comparison, and I think we're also trying to do that. That's why I suggest Anna perhaps speaks 5 minutes on, 2 minutes on what, perhaps by actually on what is going on at the European level, on data level. The other point is on policies. It's nice to say all possible policies affect health inequalities and, everything is important, but that leads to the danger of then hence nothing is important. So really we need to focus on things that we can do, and if health inequalities are given by a genetic or residual, a third of the, then we can't do anything about it, and it's no point that we make a policy initiative about it. So we have to focus on the things on which policy can have an effect. Policy can have an effect on behavior, as was mentioned before, and also I think that there is a role for social policy and for healthcare policies, and hence, for us, it is interesting to see what healthcare policies are possible and which of them have an effect or not. Because when we talk about it, what are we recommending? Are we recommending that the European Structural Fund spend more money in Eastern Europe, in Central and Eastern Europe, to build more hospitals? Are we recommending that we spend more money training more staff? Are we recommending that there should be much more interventions, much more attention on specific interventions? I pick up now on the point that was made, for example, on cancer. So perhaps if there are some specific, if the evidence shows the health inequalities is linked to specific conditions, then perhaps we should invest more on those specific conditions, on screening for those specific conditions, and that will help reduce health inequalities. To give just as an example, I think that in Romania, Romania is a relatively poor country. The level of infant mortality in Romania is really not at the European standard. And interventions on infant mortality and antenatal care, so perhaps not necessarily particularly expensive interventions, could already improve very much the level of life expectancy in Romania. So this is why I think it's important to another possible policy is should we be looking at the way healthcare is organized. Here I also was mentioned in interventions of this afternoon. Is it important that there are reimbursement, that there are out-of-pocket payments? Is it important that there are GP referrals, etc.? So all this evidence is important, and hence I go back. I go to my third point, which is that to have any kind of policy suggestion, of course, we have to have evidence-based policies. We have to have evidence. And hence, all of you are doing evaluation of policies. Thank you very much. Please continue. And this is very important. And it is important also in the argument towards financing mysteries. I mean, to take one of the points. Because, okay, it is a period of budget cuts, or in general, money is always constraining the resource. You want to make the argument that these interventions are worth a value for money, not just because it's better to make this intervention instead of all this other in healthcare, but also because the intervention in healthcare would improve the situation of the population overall compared to, for example, spending money on education. I mean, if you're saying that that health inequalities could be very well addressed by education, but then let's not spend money on hospitals, let's spend money on schools. So the argument has to be made not only within the framework of health policy, but within the framework of the overall budget. That's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's going to be fun to see how some of the issues are going to be reconciled among the economies. I guess I'm going to give the floor first to Anna, because you may want to the rest.
Yeah, I will try to explain what's called the European fairway system, which is not so easy. But basically, I think for what is important for people in the health area, now the European community household finance survey is gone. So this was replaced by an annual survey on the internal living conditions. This is the EU-SIL. And this has this so-called minimum module on health, which has the unmet need questions, the reasons for unmet need, and the self-perceived general health, self-perceived chronic disease, or limitations due to health problems. But of course, it was also understood that this was a very limited survey. And so, Eurostat, together with member states, has developed a first questionnaire of the European Health Interview Survey. So this is an interview survey, which is just on health-related questions. It asks a lot of questions about health status, and asks a lot of questions about characterization. So there is a questionnaire, which has been adopted in English, and then translated into other languages, and many member states have done the survey, or are doing it this year. Last year and this year, many member states have run this survey using different methods. Some use phones, some use person-to-person.
Each country is obliged to do this survey or not?
No. Because, in fact, at least for the first wave, not every country is doing the survey. There's a couple of countries who don't know yet if they will be doing the first wave. And there is one country, I think it's Sweden, that says we will not be doing this first wave. There will be a second wave in 2012. And the idea is that then, from then on, everybody will be doing this survey. And this is not only EU countries, but also Norway, Liechtenstein, Turkey, will be also doing this survey, and the idea is that this will run every 5 years.
In the same people or new samples?
New samples. So it's like a demographic analysis survey. What is done in developing countries? I can see that actually what Peter Salzer said, that we should learn actually not to do it the other way around, but we should learn from the experience of developing countries that have had this kind of health service going on for 25 years, comparable to 50 countries But I mean, I wonder if these different types of interviewing, I mean, telephone, the face, it's going to be a serious issue with the quality and the control and the comparability of the data. You know, I mean, I guess no, you have to be like this. I mean,
but you don't have. We have now a regulation that has been adopted by Council and Parliament, which says that you can establish rules for how member states collect public health statistics. But we haven't done the regulations, which says exactly how you are supposed to go about it. So this don't exist. So everything that exists is in a gentleman's agreement. So it is. We think you should all do this. Please do it. And then, because there's a bit of peer pressure, everybody does it. But if you think it's not Sweden, then at the moment they don't feel they have the capacity to do it, then maybe you don't do it. And can't wait anymore. So, but of course, it is that in the future this will be done. They will try also to focus on a sample of institutionalized people, and they are looking at methods to get migrant population alive. But this is all still ongoing work. Then we have some other surveys, like the European Household Budgets Survey, which may give an overall information on expenditure on health. And we have the Labour Force Survey, which has some questions on disability. And then there is ongoing work to define a more disability-focused survey. But this is still on the development stage.
What about the health examination survey?
Then there is the plans for this health examination survey. But as far as I understood, this will be done on a very small sample basis, because member state service is so costly. And the idea is that with this survey, you try to confirm the results from the health interview survey. But the question is, when will you do it? How? Because all these surveys are often not done on an individual basis. They are integrated in other surveys. It's up to the member state to decide when they will be conducting the survey. So this is another question, how will they be doing this examination survey? So it's not clear, it wasn't clear to me at the last meeting that they knew when this was going to take place and how.
So in terms of time frame, it could be that they asked in different years.
Well, I suppose you will start to prepare the things are done at the same time. But it's clear that data is as comparable as it can be, and I don't go on so much, but obviously there are member states that choose to conduct the survey throughout the seasons. There are member states who conduct the survey in only one period in time. As I said, there are some doing phone calls, there are some doing face-to-face, so...
Yeah, I'm going to stop on the data because I can go on forever.
Just to complete, so now we've talked about surveys which are being implemented all in EU member states, in principle, but of course we also have surveys like SHARE, where you have 14 countries and now also two member states participating. These are surveys which are financed through DG RTD, through the 6th, 5th, 6th, now 7th framework program. And DGRT has a policy, exactly what you said. They want to create a data infrastructure, a social science data infrastructure. SHARE is probably the best example, but there are a few other countries like the Generation and Gender Survey from the UNDCE that will maybe also get the same states as SHARE. And there's another candidate. The way it would really work is that you have a successful framework project where, let's say, countries participate, and if it's really well enough to be reviewed, then it may be lifted to this, let's say, to this SHARE status. SHARE, I have to say, is a very expensive. SHARE has costed more than 30 million euros
very expensive for the survey, and most of the others don't get that kind of money. But we also think that what is most important for the EU, what's our task? Create data sets. And then the researchers will, I'm sure, will do the work. This is where we have our added value, and I think this is the direction we have.
In my quest to be equal, I've got a slight criticism of the three people who, each of the three people who've wrapped up, because I think I took something very different away from what people have said. And I think if the EU were to go away today and just think it's all about data sets, then I would say we're back in 1983. It is not about data sets. It's about data sets, partly about that. But it's also about the interventions. And I think we've forgotten what Martin and Peter talked about, which is we need to learn what's working and what's not working. And I think that if the EU wants to put... It is about money. I know some people have said it isn't about money, but it is about money in some ways, because we need to make sure that we understand what works, and we need to understand what works in different populations and in different structures, health structures, where it's universal health service, all of these things. And the EU can do that well at an EU level, and not just measure the problem, but measure the solution as well. So if we can plead for a measure, please measure the solution as well as measuring the problem. We don't need... I mean, I think we know... In Britain, that we're very, very, very good at measuring the problem. We're much less better at measuring what the solutions are. So there's a plea for that. Secondly, I would say that you can say that everything that governments do is aimed at individuals, because we're all individuals. But at the end of the day, there are structural solutions to individual problems. And I would also not want to see an overemphasis on individual solutions in that. I think that's one of the things that Martin also talked about, that a lot of, and also Peter, we talk about solutions that are at structural levels, that are aimed upstream and downstream, but not just abandon everything and say, we're all individuals in the EU and we just need to target our individual behaviours. There's room for that, but there's room for structural and more upstream interventions. And thirdly, I would say about more local strategies, that there's also the risk with local strategies is there's local competition. And do we actually need that? I mean, my hesitation with that is I was listening to the BBC this morning, and they were talking about how fantastic the health service is in Scotland, because it's now being structured or it's being targeted locally. And I think there's lessons to learn from what is being offered locally, but there's also lessons to be learned from what's being done nationally. And that's what's happening in England right now, is that they don't understand why health inequalities are working at some levels and not at others, because they're not learning what's happening at the local level. So there's no, we don't know what's happening, the impact of upstream, you know, we don't know what's happening, if it's the impact of national targets or local initiatives. And so don't just see one as the solution and one as not the solution. I think, you know, that you've got to have some kind of balance there and learn that national targets do have an impact. And I've got a slight hesitation that the Netherlands goes away and thinks, well, if we just target this at 30, if we just decentralise it all, that's the solution. I think we know that national targets have provided some kind of impetus in England, and you know, whether or not they've actually worked, it's a long term. We'll have to know that in the long term. So I suppose I wanted to provide an alternative perception of what we've listened to today.
Yeah, I think we should underline from the Commission that the four of us all come from DG employment, and there are two DGs dealing with this, and the reason why our good and possibly more qualified colleagues from SANCO are not here is because they have to tend to the flu. So they're primarily public health. We are in healthcare systems, we try to pool our resources. The Commission is a very thin line of people. It's not a huge bureaucracy, which you may think. It's a very thin line, and we only have little money. And therefore, very much we think in terms of structures that sort of multiply our money and get member states into good series of actions. And so, primarily, the Commission will propose two things. In this initiative, it will propose that we invest in data collectively as a European community, and it will propose that we set up permanent structures of monitoring. And that's sort of how we get to the better of this. And of course, it will be policy monitoring. And so there will be periodical report by all member states, which you feed in and which allows you to compare. And then, of course, one of the most sexy aspects of what we do with our societies is what we do between them. So convergence between European countries, of course, is a very big issue. And therefore, we have a problem struggling with what is actually the relationship between reducing inequalities between member states and reducing inequalities within member states. And we would love to be told that by working on your internal inequalities, you help reduce between country inequalities. But we also had a sense that some of these grotesque between country inequalities are really related to healthcare performance. So they're very amenable in the sense that we already have the healthcare strategies that could take the top away from some of these over mortalities in some of our member states. And therefore, it will be a mix of how we move. We do think, and we know from some of our member states, for example, in Italy, before they changed government, the last government was the Prodi government, maybe you remember, they actually did develop a strategy for what the healthcare could contribute, and it was amazing to see how you can actually have a more equitable provision of healthcare, which is in many ways targeting. So if you go into specific illnesses, it's about how you follow them up compared to the environment in which people had to regenerate themselves after therapies, and then how that reduced then the differences in survival rates or the health status of these people. And it was amazing how much there was to be caught even there. So we're open to all this, but we start from the social determinants, and there, of course, Europe in itself, the Lisbon strategy, is working on all these determinants to improve the well-being of people, and in the final sum, this will somehow contribute to health. We don't know exactly how the position is, but the other big project is an internal project. We want within the Commission to try to see if we can hold all our policies to their health outcome. So this is sort of the idea of this will not happen overnight, and most people do not understand what we're saying. And sometimes when we bring down people who were supposed to help us, like Mama, they don't understand anything because they get them all to raid instead of meeting the big medical doctor. They meet the amateur moralizer. So it's also very important how this is produced, because by history, by expectation, we bow to something which appears as science, and we don't expect, or respect to the same extent, moral arguments. And we're sort of not strong people within the Commission. In order to push this, we have to prove that it's economically feasible, there are also economic benefits, and that this is well worth striving for. In the final thing, it is, of course, if we could get it into the general strategy, into the new Lisbon. So we're talking about this, but we're not big movers and shakers, but there's already one in Lisbon, and people are thinking about, should this stay, what should replace it? And we would like to replace it with other measures of health inequality, and maybe make it an overarching objective. And that would then create a greater playing field for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any reactions or comments to this? Any comments back from the panel? Or we'll kill you. There seems to be agreement that there is a bit of disagreement on this. Some of the major issues, individual versus aggregate, comparative versus individual. And I mean, I wonder some of the, I mean, for example, I mean, your point is very interesting, but how do you take that onto the comparative view at European level? I was wondering as well whether there was any response from the panel as well.
Well, just a short remark on the national and local. I think Sweden, as some of you know, is very much run by the local municipalities. And when we analyze differences between municipalities, a large proportion of that difference is unexplainable. It's not driven by political differences or anything else. It's just driven by local differences. It's just the fact that some municipalities do it this way and other municipalities do it the other way. And it has nothing to do with the evidence-based policies or anything. And actually, it's increasing regional inequalities in a sense. So that the solution to anything should be to localize all kinds of policies. I strongly disbelieve that. On the contrary, I think that it's important that the local community has an influx in how to do certain things, but that it's important that you have national targets and national standards that these local municipalities should follow. That's the common point.
Can just make one reaction to the question from over here, and then some comments on what we've heard from the representatives from the Commission. I didn't really quite understand your comment about let's not take away from this that, okay, let's collect some data, that's fine, if that means ignoring the evaluation of interventions. I mean, to evaluate interventions can't be done without data. I mean, data are crucial to do exactly that. So I don't. That's not one or the other. The reason we want the data is to do exactly that. With respect to what I've heard from the representatives from the Commission, I'm extremely encouraged, actually. I think it is definitely a great contribution which the Commission can make and the European Union can make by coordinating efforts on data. I really think that would be so. I'm really pleased to hear that the commitment is there for that. I think it can also be very useful to take this comparative approach. You mentioned about preparing these policy monitoring documents. The presentation we had this afternoon on what's happening in the Netherlands. I mean, there is some sort of reaction of this is ambitious and where's the money, etc. So, you know, things are perhaps a bit loose. But let's not forget that this is a country which has, if not the lowest, amongst the lowest health inequalities in Europe, and also very good health outcome measures. And it's a country which is, okay, but it's not. We can make some criticisms, but it is really making some effort to look at policies to address health inequalities, even when, by European standards, they're very low. Now, I think if the Commission can take that and feed that through to some other countries where the outcomes are much lower, the levels are lower, and the inequalities are greater, then that can also be an extremely valuable contribution.
Can I just chipping in on the sort of the local and national issue. I'm not certainly supportive to say that a health strategy should do without some form of national target. The difficulty comes when we try to translate that into a set of very specific differential local targets, partly because we then really don't have the sufficient sophistication actually to calibrate what those targets ought to be. But also, there's an issue of whether the target is a catalyst or a constraint. When we get, depending upon how you express the target and how you operate it, if you can try to limit the space, the organizational space that is required in order to fulfill the target, then it's a good idea. It then can act as a catalyst, can act as something that spurs local partners to work together to do this, and also potentially spurs them to find out what else they have in common that there isn't part of the national target. The danger happens when the target expands to fill the entire organisational space of the locality. And they come to us and they say, well, we can't do that because it isn't going to give us a reduction in mortality in 2010, but only in 2012. And we say, well, it isn't actually about shifting deaths from 2010 to 2012. And they say, well, that's what the target seems to imply. So we need to be fairly careful. And behind that is, I'm sharing with colleagues in the Department of Health, an inherent feeling of faith gets, if we, the Stalinist principle, that once you get the target, then people start saying that it's a good idea to overfulfill the target. If it's a good idea to fulfill the target, then doing more of the target is even better.
Yeah.
And that is very dangerous, because almost by definition, if we're economists, we can see there is a diminishing marginal utility to almost any program, and overfulfilling the target rather than doing something else will almost necessarily be suboptimal in terms of the overall performance of the system.
Would you apply that to life expectancy?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure, but it would be interesting to see how that works.
One last comment from the back panel.
I had one from the LSE. During the news today, I think there's been sort of some kind of distinction, if you like, or made between the politics and the evidence, right? And many people have sort of mentioned that. Those two things seem to me to be absolutely integrally related to achieve success in this area. So, for instance, right, you know, you look at the Marmot Review, and it's, you could argue that it's basically a new Black report, right? The Black report was published or produced in a time of major economic crisis on the brink of a new Conservative government in this country. And does that sound familiar? Yeah, and then consequently, it had no effect whatsoever, because the recommendations in the Black report just didn't fit in with the political vision of the UK government at that time. So I think you've got, well, it's up to you. If you want to have an effect, it seems to me as though you've got to tailor.